the Land Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois. This is the Closing Market Report. It is the second day of September 2010. I'm Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Kurt Kimmel. He's at Bates Commodities in Normal, Illinois. Dan Zwicker is away today at the Farm Progress Show. A bit later in the program, Gary Crawford will be here and has a comparison between farmers in the United States and those in India. And then in the second half hour of the program, we call that the Farming World, we'll hear excerpts from last week's Illinois Agriculture Association's candidate forum for governor. Today, Pat Quinn, sitting governor at the state of Illinois, a Democrat. We'll hear his comments. And then tomorrow on that same program, we'll hear from challenger Republican Bill Brady. And it all happens right here on the Closing Market Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media from the University of Illinois.
Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
In Chicago, on this Thursday afternoon, futures finished like this. The nearby September soft red winter wheat at $6.80¾, up 5¼. December at $7.13¾, a nickel higher. Those are Kansas City. Actually, those are Chicago numbers. Corn pit now. September contract to $4.33. Settlement price up $0.75. December at $4.47½, up $0.75. And March at $4.60¾, up $0.01 for the day. May corn on the day at $4.67¼, up $0.01. July at $4.72¾, up $0.01. Next year's December corn futures at $4.51¾, up $0.015. September soybeans, $10.07½, up $0.03. November at $10.09, $0.035 higher. January at $10.18½, up $0.035. And the March at $10.25, $4.25 higher. The May futures at $10.29¼, up $4¾. And July soybeans, $10.37½, a nickel higher on the afternoon. September bean meal at $3.02.20, up 30 cents. September bean oil at $39.66, up 11 cents. We'll go back and catch the hard red in Kansas City at $7.18, up 5¾ for the afternoon. Livestock numbers finished the October live cattle at $98.45. Up 70 cents for the day. December there at 101.32½, 72½ higher. September feeders at 114.75, up 87½ cents. October at 115.50, up 65. October lean hogs, $76.42½, $1.47½ higher. And December futures at $74.15, up $1.27½. You're listening to the Closing Market Report from the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. Here's what the outside markets look like at this hour. Crude oil futures October contract, $74.97 a barrel, up $1.07. September ethanol at $1.95¾, 0.9 cents higher. Natural gas at $3.77, up 0.8 cents. And heating oil or diesel fuel at $2.06¼, up 2 cents even. Gold futures for the afternoon have settled $5.20 an ounce higher at $1,251.50, and the Dow Jones Industrial Average now stands at 10,287, just about 18 points higher. The U.S. dollar down 0.05 at 82.47, and the CRB index on the afternoon at 271.15 is up 2.64 for the day. Here's what the weather forecast looks like as reported by the National Weather Service for Urbana-Champaign. This afternoon, a 50% chance of showers and thunderstorms. Should be mostly cloudy, a high near 85 degrees. South-southwest winds between 15 miles an hour and gusting up to 22. Tonight, showers and thunderstorms likely before 1 a.m. Mostly cloudy, a low around 60 degrees. West winds between 9 and 14. They'll gust up to 21. Chance of precip this evening, 60%. Friday, mostly sunny, a high near 73 degrees. That's right, only a high of 73 tomorrow. Breezy, west-northwest winds between 11 and 20 miles an hour. They'll gust as high as about 30 miles an hour. And then tomorrow night, mostly clear, a low of 51 degrees. West winds between 9 and 17 miles an hour, gusting to 24. Saturday should be sunny with a high of 71. Northwest winds between 9 and 14. Saturday night, a low of 50 and mostly clear. On Sunday, should be sunny, a high near 78 degrees. More on the agricultural weather forecast when we get to the bottom of the hour and we talk with meteorologist Pete Levitt.
Todd Gleason services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a Thursday afternoon. Dan Zwicker of ADM Grain Group is in not Decatur today, but in Boone, Iowa at the Farm Progress Show in his stead. We'll have Kurt Kimmel with us, our regular Monday analyst from Bates Commodities out of Normal, Illinois. Good afternoon to you, Kurt.
Good afternoon, Todd.
Well, let's take a look at the marketplace, talk just a bit about it. First, go through what happened today in Chicago.
Well, Dan would say it's a giddy up and go type of market. The market saw some selling during the session, the first 95% of the session, I'd say. The three-day weekend coming up on us, and the bullish news somewhat slowed down, and saw some profit taking for the most part. The momentum indicators are getting a little toppy and actually rolling over a little bit, so the market is warranted to sort of back and fill here, especially in the corn and wheat, where we got up to some recent upside objectives, resistance levels, and so forth. And the beans, for the most part, found support and sort of alleviated the oversold condition somewhat going into a close. So three-day weekend in front of us, the trade's sort of getting positioned ahead of this weekend here. Next week's going to be a big week. We got the full moon coming at us, and also the crop production numbers on Friday.
And probably a full sled of corn coming at us, too, at least out of this part of the world. Is Labor Day a time frame when things tend to change in the marketplace? There are some seasonals. Is Labor Day one of those times or not?
Last year we put the low end prior to Labor Day. Often you see trend changes going into three-day weekends. That's kind of the fear here as a trader, especially on the corn market here. If the run-up we've seen here, you can come back and see the momentum shift the other way. So it is a time window where the trade will be watching the news and the price direction real close. If you go back to the seasonality of the corn market, especially once you get past Labor Day in the first couple of weeks in September here, the trend is dominantly down as we move into the September time window in here. So we'll see if that trend develops here as we move into next week.
And that would be a trend with harvest pressure. Are there anything else that might be in the forefront of your mind that would push the market lower? I don't know that USDA would come out with a bigger number, but I suppose that's a possibility. And then the world economy has been, well, just okay, I suppose.
Well, the world economy, I mean, it's a lack of fear is going to fall apart, then the fear is going to fall apart. I mean, it's sort of a sideways atmosphere when you talk the economy here. But the other thing we need to watch real close is we got to remember this grain market has been front-end loaded on demand, and what could spook the bull a little bit if Asia would come in and say, well, they're pretty well booked up here and won't be a buyer here for another couple months. So that could be it. The other thing is yield reports. Yield reports have been somewhat discouraging from a producer's point of view, which has been bullish to the market. But we get into some areas where they received a lot more favorable weather and see some higher yield estimates come out of the field. That could temper the bullish enthusiasm.
Yeah, have you heard any producers coming up with some of those big yields yet?
Well, it varies. You know, where we're at and a lot of people we work with, corn on corn has been a disaster. You know, we've heard as low as 87 bushels. A lot of it's 110, 120. For the most part, a lot of corn's in this 150, 160 area. But we've heard some 200, 205s in a few spots. This earlier corn's, you know, going to be a tough pill to swallow, but we feel as we move along in here, yields should improve in some of the other areas of the growing region.
When we talk to the cash grain specialist, they tell us they'll have some logistical problems getting trains and moving grain that's in storage out of storage, especially because they have to blend what they've got left in the bins at some of those elevators. And they certainly have to do that down at the port, I suppose, as well. Is that going to cause a problem and for basis to widen a little more than it might usually at this time of year?
Well, you would think that we would see basis improve for some good quality corn, good heavy test weight corn to come in to blend that off, but that's not been the case as yet. But there is talk that there is the corn that needs to be blended locally here too, not only down at the Gulf. I know a large chunk of it's there. So, yeah, there's going to be a lot of blending on to try to get this poor quality through the pipeline without raising some red flags. And one observation is some of this poor quality has been shipped out already, and it has been mentioned, especially to the Asian buyers, and they've taken that without really raising a big stink about it. Whereas in the past, there was one kernel in that load that was not quite right. They raised quite a bit of ruckus about it. So that sort of confirms we've got some strong demand in Asia yet.
Yeah, that tells you that either they have an awful big demand base in livestock or they were awful short of their crop, or possibly both last year, I suppose, doesn't it?
Yeah, we feel so. Two next week on the numbers we see, we'll be watching the Chinese corn crop real close. They continue to say it's a record crop, but we'll see what the numbers are next Friday.
We had a record crop here last year under conditions, I suppose, that are relatively similar to what the Chinese growing season has been like. It's been wet, I think, for the most part, and kind of cool there, so we'll see what those numbers end up like. Take me into the livestock sector very quickly. We're up here on the top end. We've got hogs not quite at $80 yet, and cattle have been really doing quite well. What do you see in that marketplace?
On the cattle complex, we had the good run there. We looked at dollar cash trade, then we backed off here over the last 2 weeks here. Also, we've seen the packer get aggressive and secured Labor Day needs. We'll see what next week shows on the demand side of the equation. It looks like we've got a favorable weekend, so retail clearance ought to be strong. On the weekly export sales report for beef, we continue to see strong sales to Asia, so that signals that the world numbers are also lower compared here to the U.S., and demand remains relatively firm. On the hog side equation, we had our summer run-up. We saw record cutout values, record prices for some of these products that we produce, such as loins. We're running into the fall tie window here where numbers are going to pick up as we move into this fall.
All right. Anything else to add before I let you go?
Oh, dynamic market, dynamic times. Next week's going to be a big week, so put your seatbelt on.
Okay. Thanks much, Kurt, and thanks for filling in.
Very good.
Kurt Kimmel is with Bates Commodities out of Normal, Illinois. He joins us here on the Closing Market Report. That happens on a Thursday afternoon. He's our regular Monday analyst. Dan Zwicker is away today. He's with ADM Grain Group and is vacationing. Well, not really vacationing, but he's at the wet spot of the world in Boone, Iowa at the Farm Progress Show, along with Dave Dickey and Jackie Bakes and a whole slew of our other analysts out there to talk with farmers that are visiting that program. So if you happen to be out there, you won't be much longer, I suppose. It's all wrapping up this afternoon. But Dave will be back on Monday of next week to talk to us here right on the radio stations.
Agricultural programs are made possible by Risk Management Commodities Incorporated in Lafayette, Indiana, Chalmers, Indiana, and Hudsonville, Illinois. Risk Management Commodities focuses on managing risk in today's complex and sophisticated commodities market. 866-837-9027.
Hey, if you'd like to hear Kurt again, don't forget you can do that on our website at willag.org, or you can dial this number. It's 217-333-3434. We like to call that our mobile analyst portal. The number again, 217-333-3434.
Here are a couple of quick agricultural stories for the day. USDA has taken steps to authorize Roundup Ready sugar beets.
A recent court ruling returned genetically engineered sugar beets to regulated status, but that ruling does not apply to genetically engineered sugar beet root and seed crops that were planted by August the 13th of this year. The genetically engineered sugar beet root crop that has already been planted may be processed and sold as sugar. Let's move to Washington, D.C. now, where the winds of change are upon us for the November election. Senate Ag Committee members Chuck Grassley of Iowa and John Thune of South Dakota appear to be solid favorites to win re-election this November. But other senators in Washington may not be so fortunate, including Senate Ag Committee Chairman Blanche Lincoln of Arkansas. The Democrat continues to trail her Republican challenger. Those watching the races closely say a dozen seats in the Senate could go either way. And that's a quick look at the agricultural news for the afternoon. Listening to the Closing Mark Report, it is a production of Illinois Public Media. You know, there's been a lot of talk in Washington about what should happen to the estate tax, but American Farm Bureau Federation tax specialist Pat Wolf says that's not been translated into action.
Everyone here in Washington knows that unless Congress acts, the estate tax will come back on January 1st with only a $1 million exemption and a top rate of 55%. That's a tax level we haven't seen for 10 years. Everybody agrees that something needs to be done before January 1st, but the debate is over what should happen, how much estate tax relief should be provided.
Wolf says there is nothing certain about what Congress will and won't do.
We do know that it's queuing up. The House of Representatives has already passed a bill. Their bill would set a $3.5 million exemption. Top rate of 45. The Senate is where everything is gummed up, but the Senate is also where we think we can do better than the House, because two very important senators, Senator John Kyle from Arizona and Blanche Lincoln from Arkansas, have agreed and are trying to get the exemption level up to $5 million.
Wolf says Farm Bureau would like to get rid of the estate tax altogether, but there are not enough votes to make that one happen.
So that's the bad news, but the good news is that there aren't 60 votes for the other proposals either, and some of those proposals would take the exemption down to $1 million. So everything is possible and nothing is possible all at the same time.
Farm Bureau has stressed to Congress that estate taxes can hit farm families harder than other small business owners because 84% of the farm assets are real estate based. Let's stay with national economics and policy for just a bit. Yesterday's New York Times carried a story about strong exports lifting the U.S. agriculture sector. The story says USDA's increased estimates of farm exports and farm income confirm what economists have been saying for months. Agriculture remains a bright spot going forward. Doan Advisory Services Ag Services Director Dan Mantermach explains why agriculture has not been hit as hard by recession as many other segments of the economy.
The big reason is that agriculture didn't participate in that real estate bubble. Banks weren't suddenly letting farmers take on huge debt they couldn't afford with the idea of selling that debt to the government and passing on the default risk to taxpayers. Also, the U.S. economy as a whole has become mostly a service-oriented, a service and sales economy, you might say. Manufacturing and most production has gone overseas, whereas U.S. agriculture is still a very competitive producer globally, and agriculture produces a needed product, food.
Mantermach says there are four factors influencing the growing demand for U.S. farm products.
The big picture thing is you got rising per capita income in the developing world. Another one is rapid growth in ethanol use has helped drive corn prices higher, pulling other commodity prices up with it. A decline in the dollar has been a driving force behind the demand. We saw the value of the U.S. dollar drop 36% from 2003 to 2008. But the fourth one is probably one of the bigger ones, and that's interest in commodities as a store of value by these big trading funds. Investors are worried about inflation, worried about U.S. monetary policy, and they know the government can't go out and print more wheat or print more soybeans or print more corn.
That was Ag Services Director for Doan Advisory Services, Dan Mantermach. You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It's a production of Illinois Public Media.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and Moline. More information is available from Tim Wells in Moline at 309-797-7369. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
Please do visit our website. The address is willag.org. That's W-I-L-L-A-G.O-R-G. There you'll find everything from our pre-opening market report to the closing market report, including Commodity Week. It's our weekly look at what happened in the world of commodity markets. Our guest this week, we record at 4:30 on Friday afternoons, will be Jim Bauer of Bauer Trading. Well, up next, farmers from the United States and those from India work under vastly different circumstances but share a common goal. Gary Crawford from the United States Department of Agriculture has more.
It's a common belief that farmers are basically the same no matter what country they live in, even though their circumstances may be vastly different. Certainly, if you look at farmers in India, for example, you see a very different situation than for most U.S. farmers. First of all, if there is strength in numbers, then farmers in India have a lot of political and economic strength.
India has 114 million registered farm establishments, so over 100 million farmers.
Wow, compare that to the roughly 2 million farmers in this country. This from Holly Higgins, U.S. Department of Agriculture Ag Minister Counselor stationed in New Delhi. While U.S. farmers account for about 1% of the gross domestic product of this country, farmers in India contribute about 17% of that country's economic output. This even though Indian farms are far smaller than U.S. operations, the average size of an American farm 449 acres or so. But Higgins says
the average farm size in India is 3 to 5 acres.
And it's usually a diversified farm, far more so than U.S. farms. And Higgins says also
one of the big differences is that in most parts of India, farmers live in a village and they travel out to their land. So they're very interested in the fact that our farmers live on their land. And they take that as a sign of pride in owning your land and good stewardship, that we would live right on top of our fields, that that's a positive sign.
American farmers would say that's a positive as well. So that's one similarity. Also, U.S. farmers are always interested in insurance, crop insurance, disaster aid, revenue protection. And Higgins says so are farmers in India, even though there's not much of that over there.
I get lots of questions about weather insurance and crop insurance and how does that really work, because those tools are not developed well in India. I get questions about how American farmers manage price risk, because in India, the futures markets are either banned or they're not used widely.
However, one technology is really catching on there and being used for all sorts of things. Yes, the cell phone.
Some Indian farmers, certainly not all, can get prices on their cell phones, information about the weather to a certain extent. But that's a developing technology. It's not a widespread technology.
But it is rapidly growing, helping farmers in India do the same thing that farmers here are trying to do, just make a living from the land. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Washington.
And I'm Todd Gleason here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. This is the Closing Market Report. We'll return in just 2 minutes when we'll take a complete look at the agricultural weather forecast.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
It's National Blueberry Popsicle Day. On this day in agricultural history in 1666, the Great Fire of London began in the shop of the King's Baker. After burning for 4 days, more than 13,000 buildings had been destroyed. In 1752, it was the last day of the Julian calendar in Great Britain and the British colonies. The Gregorian calendar, designed to correct the extra leap year day problem, went into effect the next day, tomorrow being September 14th. Hence, 11 days were dropped. Most other countries made the adjustment in 1582. In 1930, the first non-stop airplane flight from Europe to the U.S. became a reality as a pair of French pilots landed in Valley Stream, New York, after a 37-hour flight across the Pacific. In 1935, the Labor Day hurricane hit the Florida Keys. Over 400 were killed and the railway to Key West was destroyed. Winds were estimated at 200 miles per hour. And in 1995, Bjork Hillstrom died. He was the inventor of the Civil Compass, which featured a rotation compass dial and a transparent protractor base plate. He also wrote, "Be expert with map and compass, considered by many to be the Bible of orienteering." And that's this day in agricultural history.
This is the Closing Market Report from the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. Pete Levitt, meteorologist, is on the phone line with us to take a look at the agricultural weather forecast. Good afternoon to you, Pete.
Good afternoon, Todd.
Kind of been soggy out west in Iowa around Boone and Ames and Des Moines area where they've been holding the Farm Progress Show 4 inches earlier in the week overnight, at least one night. Will they get any relief?
Yes, I think so. I think the last in a series of systems is just coming through there now. It's coming across west central Iowa at the present time, a nice cold front with some showers and not a heck of a lot of rain with these showers. And that front will move on eastward across eastern Iowa, clearing behind it. Then you're going to get windy and cooler. And the big word here is drier weather is coming in for the weekend. We're going to see some temperatures really we haven't seen since back in May, because you don't realize what a persistently hot summer it's been. Temperatures in the local area in north central Illinois, we'll only see a max up around 70 degrees on Saturday and a minute in temperature in the upper 40s and then in the 70s on Sunday. Should be a beautiful weekend after this front gets by.
Wow, sounds like it'll be gorgeous. You mentioned the persistent heat that we've had, and I'm not sure that we all captured all of that simply because there weren't a whole lot of 100-degree days around. But it was really hot for the month of August, June,
July. That's how you get these very hot months. It's not necessarily the extremes of temperature. As you rightly point out, we really didn't have all of those extremes. But we just had persistence, and especially with a lot of moisture around, we had persistently high minimum temperatures. And, of course, the average is the range between the maximum and the minimum and the mean temperature. And so that was high, and that's where you get these sort of record warmth periods. And it was just the utter persistence, a characteristic of the pattern, by the way, that's been with us now for a couple of years. We've been in patterns that have high degrees of persistence. And when you get in one end of the pattern, say a dry end, a wet end, a cool end, a warm end, you tend to stay there and sometimes a lot longer than you'd like to.
Hey, you mentioned that the subsoil moistures or the moisture levels were responsible in part for the higher minimum temperatures in the evening. Why is that the case?
Well, it's because a lot of the moisture that gets into the atmosphere comes from evapotranspiration. The crop itself, a large crop as you have out there, is a wonderful moisturizer for the lower atmosphere. It may not seem so wonderful when it gets really warm and sticky, but, you know, people have walked into a cornfield when it's mostly 80s out on their front yard, and they get in the cornfield, and it's in the upper 90s or 100s, and it's like a steam bath in there when it's pumping all this moisture up out of the soil, and that's what makes the corn grow, but it's also what makes it so humid and muggy.
Anything else to add before I let you go?
Well, I've been working on the hurricane, as you might imagine, most of the day, since here in Massachusetts we're going to have a hurricane greet us tomorrow night, and so that's been occupying our time. It's a good storm, but fortunately it's going to miss most of the major areas, and it's just Cape Cod that's going to have their weekend dampened. Otherwise, I think people are going to, after some showers in the east, we'll see a very lovely weekend. And, of course, the weekend, I think, in the Midwest should be just great.
Thanks, Pete.
My pleasure.
Pete Levitt here on the Closing Market Report.
Support comes from Stuart Peterson, since 1985 offering strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks. The firm develops strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is available at www.stuart-peterson.com.
This is the Farming World. I'm Todd Gleason. Last week, the Illinois Agriculture Association held its candidates forum on a farm outside Bloomington. Today and tomorrow, we'll hear excerpts from the speeches made by Republican candidate State Senator Bill Brady and Democrat candidate and current governor Pat Quinn. Today, we'll pick up with Pat Quinn's opening comments.
Especially rural Illinois. It's important for our health care and our hospitals. We've linked up our rural hospitals in Illinois in a high-speed network with hospitals around the world. We've also have to make sure we have high-speed internet for education. Some people may not be able to be in place at a community college or a four-year university, but they can take online courses. It's important to have high-speed internet. Same way with our business, with our farming, with our law enforcement. We've really, I think, made strides in the right direction. We have to continue to do that. Another thing we've worked on with the Rural Affairs Council is making sure that we have good health care, decent health care, working with our local community hospitals. I think if you go to the community hospitals of Illinois, they'll tell you that Governor Pat Quinn is the best thing since Swiss cheese. We've been able to work with these hospitals. I'm going to be down in Benton coming up here this weekend, as well as Carmi. It's in some cases rescuing hospitals. We put capital money together to make sure the hospital is rebuilt and still standing. And we've also worked with our Illinois Hospital Association, especially the smaller hospitals, to make sure they're still there. It's very hard to have a good, strong community if you don't have good health care. Same way with education. At the University of Illinois, the Board of Trustees, I'm on it as governor, but it's important to have a Board of Trustees that represents all of Illinois. And I did put a trustee on there who was very familiar with agriculture, and he's done a good job. And I think it's important that we honor our great College of Agriculture there, elsewhere across Illinois, and also honor our community colleges. We have 48 community colleges in Illinois, every part of our state, including rural Illinois, and we want to make sure we invest in our community colleges. We have more students in community college than we have in our four-year universities. We've got to have a program for their education. We have 400,000 students in Illinois who are needy but have the ability to do college work, both at community college level and a four-year university, and our state provides scholarships for them. And this is indispensable. They couldn't go to college otherwise. Sometimes they're the very first person in their family to go to college, and they stay in the community. That's so important. We don't want people a brain drain leaving Illinois. Now, there are those, and you'll hear them tonight, who want to cut education in Illinois. And I think this is a very important issue for the people of agriculture in rural Illinois to keep in mind. I am a governor who believes in investing in education. I had the guts, the courage, the fortitude to stand in the middle of the arena and say we have to have a surcharge for more revenue for education in the state of Illinois, for all schools, every single school district, a surcharge that will produce about $3 billion to invest in education, including early childhood education, in every part of Illinois, making sure our K-12 is properly financed. I had to go to Washington, you know, this past year to get more federal funding on an emergency basis for our schools. The candidate you're going to hear later today, he said the governor shouldn't go to Washington to get more federal money for education. I don't understand that. We pay taxes, they go to Washington, why can't we get a return back? I think that's very important. And I also believe, not only in community colleges, our four-year universities, and our scholarship program, but we have to make sure that we hold down and reduce property taxes in Illinois. If the state of Illinois cuts its education budget by $1.2 billion, and that's what my opponent is proposing, more than $1 billion cut in from the education budget. It's about 20,000 teachers. That's overcrowded classrooms, and that's higher property taxes. Now, your organization for years has commendably fought to reduce the property tax burden on families, on businesses, and farmers across Illinois. Our state constitution says the state has the responsibility to fund at least half the cost of education in Illinois. It's not living up to it. I'm trying to make it live up to it. I believe the state should fund education properly. And if the state share goes down, that means the burden gets pushed more on to property owners all across this state. That's a central issue in this campaign. I think we need to keep that in mind. I'm the one who wants to cut property taxes and invest in education. If we don't invest in education, we're not going to have good jobs today or tomorrow. Jobs follow brain power. Your work is ever more sophisticated. It's very, very important that we educate people to the maximum ability we can in Illinois. We don't want any state in the union to out-educate our state. We're number one, and we want to keep it that way when it comes to schools. We want to make sure we have smart people. Now, having said that, another ingredient for a strong economy, not only exports, not only investing in all parts of Illinois, including rural Illinois, and having high-speed internet, not only having a fair investment in education and lower property taxes, which we have to do, but we also have to have good infrastructure. We have to have good roads and safe bridges. Now, last year, for the first time in 10 years, Illinois passed a bill that I signed into law to invest in our infrastructure, make sure we have safe roads, safe bridges, good water systems. We invest in water, good rail systems, unsnarl the bottlenecks, rebuild some of our schools that are falling apart, build new schools in some cases, and also build university buildings, rebuild them. The University of Illinois, Lincoln Hall, is falling apart. We got to make sure that classroom building is rebuilt. So we have to pay for this. You understand this. There are some in politics, you'll hear them in this campaign, it's 10 weeks from yesterday is the election, they're going to tell you a lot of things that sound good if you say them fast, okay? I'm here to tell you the truth, and I think we need a governor after two governors who got on the wrong side by not telling the truth. You need a truth teller as a governor, a straight shooter. The fact of the matter is that if we're going to have good infrastructure, and our state last year had the lowest number of traffic fatalities since 1921. That's because we invest, as we are this year, in 5,000 miles of road repair and road building. The largest road building project in the history of Illinois this year. 666 bridges this year, making them safe. So if things go over that bridge, they don't fall into the water, into the ditch. We've got to make these fundamental investments in our economy today, or we will suffer today and tomorrow. Now, last year, the crucial vote came. We had to pay for these bonds, $31 billion. That's this program, federal money and state money, local money. But the state had to do its share. I had the courage to say, yes, here's the financing package. I'm for it, and I got a majority, three-fifths of the legislature, to vote for it. My opponent didn't vote for it. Now, he'll show up over here at Normal at all the ribbon cuttings. You know, he'll be happy to show up at all the spending of the money. But I got the funding for the bonds that are going to make our state stronger economically and our agriculture stronger. You can't get goods to the market unless we have good transportation. So I think that's a very important issue to keep in mind. Our state, since the beginning of this year, has created more economic jobs than other Midwestern states. We had, a great opportunity to keep doing that. Ford Motor Company, one of the largest companies on planet Earth, picked Illinois for 1,200 new manufacturing jobs. Boeing, I used to live in Madison County, St. Clair County, they are bringing manufacturing jobs to Illinois for the first time. We're working with Fiat Chrysler and many, many other companies, large and small, because we want to have a good, strong economy, but it begins with agriculture. Our strongest part of the Illinois economy is agriculture. 40% of the economy is agriculture. I'm a governor who understands that. I've worked with that, the state treasurer, lieutenant governor, and now governor. So I look forward to working with everybody here to make sure we have an honest government, and I believe in that. I'm an honest governor. You know, I assumed office probably the toughest time in Illinois history. We've straightened out things that were wrong, and we're going to keep it that way. We're not going to have people laughing at our state. We're going to make sure we do things right all the time. That's what I've follow my conscience all my life. I believe in recall. It's on the ballot this year. We're going to have recall amendments for people to vote on whether we put it in our Constitution. I think it should be there because if we run across a bad apple, whether it's George Ryan or Rob Blagojevich, they ought to be removed from office before their term is up. The voters will have a chance to do that if we have recall. I've been fighting for recall for 33 years, and this year it's on the ballot. So I hope we can have your support on that and all other good things. And without further ado, I'm glad to answer any questions. Okay.
If you'd do have questions, pass them to the outside and we'll pick them up. First question deals with the first couple, business climate issues. As you know, over the last decade, we've lost approximately 400,000 jobs in Illinois. We've seen number of concerns as it relates to the permitting of ethanol plants and such. How do we turn around the business climate in this state, as you just were alluding to, Governor, to try to attract more business back into Illinois and certainly enhance the business that we do have?
I think having a good business climate involves having good education, having good infrastructure. I believe in investing in education, investing in the infrastructure. That's why we passed a very large bill that will create a lot of jobs and have good infrastructure for the people. It also includes broadband deployment. Ford could have gone anywhere in the world with the manufacturing expansion that they had. They told me about a year ago, if you want to be in the competition, roll up your sleeves, get going. And so we did. We passed laws in Springfield, and we got one of the largest expansions in Illinois history in automotive. And we're working with Chrysler right now on the same thing. Having said that, small business means big business for Illinois. And so we have a small business job creation tax credit that I got passed. That provides a $2,500 tax credit for every new job that somebody in small business creates. And so the way I work on it, Phil, is I work with individual businesses wherever they come from. If they're large or small, they're all the same to me. We work together. And earlier today, I was working on one of those. And we want to make sure that our state does grow economically. You're going to hear a lot about how many thousand jobs Illinois lost. Our country lost 8 million jobs. 8 million jobs. Now, President Bush was president. It's the greatest recession since the Great Depression. Okay? There's people on Wall Street that ran the American economy into a ditch. And that's the long and the short of it. Now, our state suffered just like every other state. Now, the fact of the matter is we're getting out of the ditch. Now, the people who are helping get us out of the ditch, pushing and pulling, that's me. You know, they're gonna have some folks over there leaning on a shovel saying, do it faster, okay? I'm doing the pushing. And I believe that we have had a very good year this year, thanks partly to the bill we passed last year for job recovery and infrastructure, and then also our various programs that have created jobs. Illinois has a better job creation record than other Midwestern states this year. That's not to say we don't have a long, long way to go. But agriculture, to me, is a key part of getting out of the ditch, moving forward with strong export, strong products, the strong agricultural industry. I've been to the Farm Progress Show in Decatur on numerous occasions, and I was with Phil, I think, last year on that fine day. And I understand that ADM and John Deere and Caterpillar and all them, they're very important to our state. But most important are the individual men and women in agriculture who are on the front line making it happen.
As you know, we have roughly a $14 billion budget deficit, the largest unfunded pension liability in the country. How do you plan on addressing this going forward, and what specifically do you propose to address the unpaid bills and the long-term debt?
Okay, January 29th last year, I got sworn in. The guy before me got impeached and removed from office. First time that ever happened in Illinois history since our state began in 1818. Our national economy was in a spiral down, the greatest recession since the Great Depression. And we had a budget deficit in Illinois of over $10 billion. So I said, yes, I'm ready to go. Okay. It's not an easy job to navigate our state through these tough economic times. But we are Illinois citizens who are good and true, second to none. I have total faith in the people of Illinois on the issue of the budget. Well, George Will, who's probably not a great Democrat, last time I checked, said that we passed in Illinois, and I signed into law, the most far-reaching public pension reform law ever passed by any state in the history of the United States. We passed it this year. It's going to save the taxpayers of our state $220 billion over the next generation. It's going to reduce our public pension costs. Now, I went to a couple union gatherings, and they stood up and gave me a standing ovation for 3 minutes. They weren't very happy with it. But part of the job of governor is not to just tell you what you want to hear. You got to have a person that tells you what you need to know. And we got that reform passed, and we also are dealing with getting our budget under control. I've cut the budget $3 billion, $3 billion, more than any governor in Illinois history. Cut my own office budget 35%, far more than any governor ever in the history of Illinois, my own budget. Cut my own pay. I take furlough days or days off without pay, 24 of them. The guy running against me, he didn't cut his pay. Matter of fact, there was a vote in the House, in the Senate, I'm sorry, on whether or not to reduce your pay if you're a senator. He voted against it. He voted against taking unpaid days off. He voted against reducing his expenses. I've done that. You know, if you're going to do it, you better do it if you're governor, and that's what I'm doing. Now, having said that, we also, in addition to cutting costs, got to have a stronger economy. We're building that economy. And we also have to get money from Washington that we're entitled to. I'm not going to leave money on the table in Washington, D.C., as my opponent wants to do. He said, no, the governor of Illinois shouldn't go to Washington to get money for education and health care. Well, I went with a lot of other Republican and Democratic governors over and over again to tell those people in Washington we need the money back home. That's what governors do. That's what leadership is. The notion you just sit back and watch the world go by, that isn't my brand of leadership. So how do we get out of the deficit and pay the bills? Steady, strong, cutting the budget where it has to be cut, making sure we have a stronger economy, getting every penny we're entitled to from Washington, and yes, I do believe we need revenue to pay for education, more revenue. I'm for a 1% surcharge on individuals and the Illinois income tax to help pay exclusively for our schools. That's about $3 billion to pay the bills down. I think that's an investment in human capital that'll hold down local property taxes. The other fellow's going to tell you, I'm not going to raise any taxes. Oh, yeah? He wants to raise a local property tax. Matter of fact, he was down at State Fair, and he said, well, there'll be some natural rise in local property taxes. That's what we've been hearing for years and years. The most unpopular tax in Illinois is the property tax. It's used to fund the most important part of the 21st century, our education. Are we going to use a 19th century property tax to help fund the most important part of the 21st century, learning, education? I think we ought to make the state pay its fair share using the income tax based on ability to pay. That's a principle as old as the Bible. Taxes should be based on ability to pay. Nobody likes taxes. I don't. I used to be the tax appeal commissioner in Cook County, and I heard people over and over again say how unfair the property tax is. If we're ever, ever going to reform the property tax, now is the time, and I'm the person that's going to do it.
Next question is kind of interesting, Governor, since we do have the Director of Ag, Tom Jennings, in the back.
Mm-hmm. There he is.
How do you see the role of the Illinois Department of Agriculture in your administration, and what qualities will you be looking for in a director for the Department of Ag?
Well, Tom's done a real nice job, and I want to thank Tom for his steadfast leadership in the department, not just in the time I've been governor, but before my time. We had a great state fair. I was at the state fair. We celebrate agriculture. I want to make it crystal clear. Some of the advisors of my opponent are calling for an end to the state fair, an end to county fairs. Over my cold, dead body, we're never going to do that. We believe in celebrating agriculture and celebrating Illinois. This is a gathering of our state to honor something that's been around for, I think, 1857. The gate at the state fair is 100 years old this very year. And I've been going to state fair ever since I've been breathing. And I think it's important that we have a strong Department of Agriculture that works with our men and women in agriculture on everything they need, especially on getting our exports as far as we can go. We can feed the world. We know that in Illinois. We can fuel the world. We understand the importance of biofuels. You know, there's only one candidate for governor, only one, who's been nominated and declared Mr. Soybean in Illinois, and that's me. Okay, the Illinois Soybean Association said several years ago that I did so much for soybeans that I could be Mr. Soybean, and so they started calling me Soy Boy, and I don't care. They can make fun of me, but the bottom line is soybeans and corn and all the other agricultural products, they not only feed people, but they also provide fuel for many vehicles. And the bio revolution that we're now in, we have to understand that biotechnology is a great, great opportunity for agriculture. We want to work with all of those institutions in Illinois, the pharmaceutical companies, the universities, the research labs, all the various entities that believe in a bio future. Agriculture is right there, and I've been at those bio conventions. We had a huge one this year, and I really look forward to working with people on that.
Two questions as it relates to livestock. As you know, livestock is a huge portion of agriculture in this state. What policies would you put in place to encourage a vibrant livestock industry? And then there's a follow-up.
Yeah, we have a couple of opportunities to do well with livestock in a major way in Illinois. I'm working with them. We have still work to do. But I think we can have a strong livestock industry in Illinois. I think we may be having opportunities that we never, ever imagined we could have. And so I want to make sure we develop those. You have to work on a variety of different fronts. We have to make sure we cover the environmental front, but our agricultural department is leading the way in that area too. We have to make sure that our products, our meat products, can compete with anyone in the world, and they're safe and sound. And I think that's one of our comparative advantages.
And the follow-up to that is the concern about the Joe Davies County Dairy and the letter that you sent to EPA to order further testing. Will you eventually support this farm's operation?
Well, that depends on the water situation. As Lieutenant Governor and Governor, I'm doing both jobs now, it's important that we understand that clean water and safe water are very important to all of us in Illinois, in agriculture and everyone who drinks water. So there are, in my judgment, questions about the facility there and its impact on the water supply. And you have to make judgments, balanced judgments about that. Mark Twain, who lived 100 years ago, he died in 1910, he said, whiskey's for drinking and water's worth fighting for. So we'll want to work with everybody in agriculture. We know there are certain parts of our state that really have water scarcity. We got to help them. I've worked on that issue. That's why in our capital bill that we passed last year, we have significant resources for clean water in many, many rural communities. It's unfortunately not good. In some parts of Illinois, the drinking water and the water that people have in rural communities is not the way it should be, and we've got to invest in that. But it takes, again, a governor who has the fortitude to say to the people, we're going to have to raise some money here in order to pay for bonds, in order to do big things that help us today and tomorrow. And that's where I believe water comes in.
A couple questions, Governor, on the Illinois EPA. As you know, there's a number of regulations impacting a lot of people that are under this tent tonight. Mm-hmm. And I think the concern is, what emphasis will you give the director of EPA here in this state and the willingness to put common sense back into some of these regulatory challenges?
Well, I think that is a challenge for any regulator to apply real-world experience and common sense to their job. There is a law. Interpreting the law as the U.S. EPA or the Illinois EPA does is always a mission that someone has to take seriously when they take an oath of office. But I do expect everybody I appoint to use their common sense in enforcing the law. Doug Scott is our EPA director, and Mark Miller is our Department of Natural Resources director. As you know, when I became governor, there were certain parks in Illinois that were padlocked, closed. Within a short period of time, we reopened them. And I think our Department of Natural Resources has been a very strong advocate of making sure that things are done right. We've worked very much, very well, I think, on getting as much CREP money as we possibly can. The Conservation Reserve Enhancement Program, which I worked on as Lieutenant Governor year after year, we did great things, and we can do more. And I do want to work with all of our men and women in agriculture on things we can do to have sustainable agriculture, to take care of the fertility of our soil, to make sure it's top-notch, and to also make sure we don't have erosion going into waterways. It hurts all of us. And I think I understand that issue pretty well. Well, not too far from here in Peoria, there was all that mud, sediment at the bottom of the Illinois River, and we figured out a way to deal with that. We got some money together, and we used barges and dredge up that mud at the bottom of the river, put it on the barges, and send it back to Chicago. And they slather that mud onto what used to be the U.S. Steelworks. Huge, huge site. It's bigger than the Loop up there. You're going to create a whole new neighborhood, but the steelworks were slag. You can't grow anything on it. You can't grow anything. Trees, flowers, nothing. So you had to put the mud on it, this fertile mud at the bottom of the Illinois River. And we brought a barge after barge. We won a national award for this program. It was called Mud to Parks. Mud to Parks. We're going to keep doing it. We got more money in our budget, capital budget, to do so, to create a new park and a new area of commerce and economic development in Chicago, but also help the Illinois River become deeper. We've got to get our goods to market. We've got to make sure our ships and our barges can get through. It's getting too shallow. I understand that. I've worked with Ray LaHood on this issue quite a bit. He was right with me when we were digging up that first bucket of mud. And I said then, and I'll say today, this is good mudslinging in Illinois. I believe in good mudslinging.
Governor, a number of people here tonight have been part of the vision for Illinois agriculture, and we've done a lot of work over the last couple of years of trying to say, where do we want Illinois agriculture to be in the next 5 years, 10 years? Incorporated in that vision are our working implementation steps, part of the SMART agenda, whether that's business climate, attracting the best and brightest and keeping them in agriculture. What's your feeling on that vision project going forward as governor?
I think it's very, very important to have this project and implement the project. We do not want a brain drain from our state where kids are educated here, go elsewhere to another state. And we don't want a brain drain from our rural communities where kids who grew up in a rural community really love that way of life, would really rather raise their family there. For one reason or another, most of the time economic, they move away. And so that's why I believe so much in investing in education. If you have good schools and good health care in every county in the state, if we have good access to high-speed internet and a good way of life, a safe way of life, where you can go to bed at night and not even lock your door, to me that's what we have to aim for in rural Illinois. And part of that is if you don't invest in schools, if your rural schools are under, they don't have enough money to get good teachers and have the programs you need, families don't stay. And so you have to have a governor who tells people the truth. If you don't have the state investing in education, if you go the opposite way, the way of cutting education by over $1 billion, that means no, less teachers, overcrowded classrooms, and higher property taxes. We can't let people in this election campaign engage in fuzzy math, okay? You got to pay the bills. I understand that. I don't enjoy telling people we got to get more revenue to pay the bills, but somebody has to be a truth teller here. After 10 years of George Ryan, Rob Blagojevich, who didn't tell people straight. I don't want to go back to that with a governor who can't even tell you before the election how he would arrange the budget. I told everybody. It's out there, it's crystal clear. And I think it's important to have governors who tell people the truth.
With the state of Illinois and the, quote, state of bankruptcy, why not stop all unfunded mandates?
Well, number one, our state has paid every single bill. Now, we have late payment. I don't deny that. But by the year's end, every bill that the state owes will be paid. And that's been the way. We pay all the pension obligations. We've reduced our future pension obligations by $220 billion. But when you say unfunded mandates, I don't believe the state should be imposing mandates on local governments that cost money without providing the money. So we are very careful on that. Under my time, I don't think we've really imposed mandates that cost money for local governments, and I don't intend to do that.
Illinois' fee structure is higher than neighboring states. Would you favor lowering fees to retain small businesses?
Well, I'm willing to look at any particular fee that the state government levies to determine whether or not it's worth it or not. Having said that, some of the money to pay for our bonds, to build new roads and repair the old roads, to make sure our bridges are safe, to make sure we have modern rail systems that can get our goods to market, to make sure we take care of our water, again, to get goods to market as well as to have clean water everywhere, and to make sure we build new school buildings where they're falling apart. There are some fees attached to that. And I supported that because if we didn't have a higher vehicle fee, then we wouldn't be able to invest in the roads. Now, I think it's important to make sure we save lives. As I said earlier, Illinois has, this past year, a very good record at reducing traffic fatalities and having literally millions and millions of miles more driven on our roads because we understand we have to engineer them in a 21st century way to save lives. So I believe in that, and individual fees I'd be glad to look at any which way.
This one's a school board member question. Mm-hmm. As a school board member trying to put a budget together next year, how can we do this when we do not know if or when and how much money we are going to get from the state?
Mm-hmm. Well, this was a struggle this year. I proposed a 1% surcharge on individuals on the income tax in order to get more revenue for our schools. And I mean all schools. I not only K-12, but early childhood education, as well as community colleges, four-year universities, and definitely scholarships for our needy students. My opponent wants to cut scholarships for needy students by a huge amount, millions of bucks. I didn't want to do that. And what we did this year, we had a struggle, but we were able, despite all the things, we cut everywhere we could to preserve education. And this year, this budget, this fiscal year, we'll actually have more money for education than the previous year. Part of the reason is we just got, from Washington, $415 million for our schools, every single school in Illinois, to keep teachers working. We don't want to lay them off. We want them to work and teach and make sure we have a learning society. Now, I was the one who helped get that with governors everywhere. The fellow running against me, he said, you shouldn't have gone to Washington. We talked about that earlier. But the bottom line is, for our schools, if I win the election on November 2nd, I sure hope I do, we will have an investment in education. I think the people will speak. If we have an investment in education, then we will be able to do, I think, a better budget for schools and an earlier budget, but also a mission that we have to dedicate ourselves to. We can't continue to have a decrepit, unfair, complicated, confusing property tax system. If anybody, the Farm Bureau and the Farmers of Illinois have fought hard for property tax reform and reducing property taxes. It shouldn't be used in the 21st century to an undue degree to fund our schools. It's bad for rural communities. It's bad for every community. So you have a governor here now who's committed to that. And you have another person who wants to cut the state investment in education by $1.2 billion. If that happens, what do you think is going to happen to your local property taxes? They're going up. We have to understand what that reality is.
Last question. As you know, we haven't done anything on the estate tax as it relates to the federal level. Illinois was tied to that. So this year there is not an estate tax in place. If at the federal level something is done, what would your opinion as governor be in addressing or not addressing it at the state level going forward?
Well, I believe there should be a very generous exemption on the estate tax that would really cover 99% or 98% of the people of Illinois and their estates. And that's my philosophy. I think if you have a mega estate, there may be an argument for an estate tax there, and I think that's true at the federal level and at the local level. But I'm not interested in modest estates, people who are the heart and soul of Illinois, we should have a generous exemption for them. Okay, well, I really appreciate the opportunity to be here. I'm not a stranger. I've been to every part of Illinois over the last 30 years, more than that. I got started by passing a petition to stop politicians in Illinois from collecting their whole pay on the first day of office. We gathered 635,158 signatures, filed them in Springfield, got a law passed against advance pay for politicians. They got to be paid after they work, not a year ahead of time. And that got me started. I believe in people. everyday people. I think they're the heart and soul of our country and our democracy. I believe in democracy. I think it's the greatest gift God's ever given us. Government of the people and by the people, for the people. Shall not perish from this earth. That's what Abraham Lincoln said in 272 words at Gettysburg in Pennsylvania in November of 1863. He came from our state, and I think Abraham Lincoln said then, and it's true today, what we always have to believe in. Everyday people are the ones who count. I've always tried to do that in every elected office I had, and definitely as governor. Now, a year ago, about this time, I was in Iraq and Afghanistan. And they have agriculture there, nothing like ours. But we had 3,200 men and women from Illinois in Afghanistan alone, citizen soldiers. Some of them were farmers. Some of them were sheriff's deputies. Some of them were bus drivers. Some were teachers. They were our citizen soldiers from our state. The largest deployment of the Illinois National Guard since World War II. And I'm the commander-in-chief of the National Guard. And I was so proud of the effort all of our soldiers put in. They never complained. There was never bitterness, never pettiness, never name-calling. It was really an inspiration. I was very proud of the people of Illinois when our men and women came home. I was at many, many welcoming home ceremonies, and the people of Illinois came out and saluted real heroes. And that, to me, is the model for what we have to do as our state. You're always going to have political disagreements, but you have to have leaders who know how to put people together and get things done. A year or so ago, when I signed that bill to invest in our infrastructure in Illinois, for 10 years they had all that name-calling and no action. We got it done in 10 weeks. When I passed all these ethics laws to straighten out and clean up the Illinois government, a lot of them were 10 years in waiting or more. We got it done in a short period of time. And so you got to have a governor who understands that education is the most important force for equal opportunity in our state. And every boy or girl, no matter where they live, in an inner city or in a rural area, entitled to a good school and good education. And so I believe in that. I believe in you. I believe in agriculture. We're going to feed the world, fuel the world, heal the world, and make the world better. Thank you very much.
That was Governor Pat Quinn at last week's Illinois Agriculture Association Legislative Forum. Tomorrow we'll hear from Republican challenger Illinois State Senator Bill Brady. You've been listening to The Farming World. I'm Todd Gleason.